Coming at you live from the surprise political epiphany of the director of Five Hole, Tales of Hockey Erotica, it's Cartoon Night in Canada.
Hey, what you watching?
Got a problem with cartoon?
Yet another episode of Cartoon Night in Canada, a nostalgic podcast where we dig through the animated past to find what cartoons made here in Canada are worth remembering. I'm your co-host, Chris Lucy Antonio.
And I'm your co-host, Sylvie Kettles.
And it's finally time that we got political on this podcast, Sylvie.
Oh, God.
No, you don't get to say that because we have been political this entire time, and I've had to censor you,
yes,
if you remember, for...
Only once!
For going a little too far...
I don't think I went far enough.
No, and I agreed with your statement, which has been lost to the sands of time, thankfully.
Yeah, but we'll never know what it was.
If it has not been obvious this entire time, both myself and Sylvie are somewhat outspoken politically. We don't hide our political beliefs, even when speaking on children's entertainment, because it's all very much relevant, and you're all cowards.
Every piece of art is inherently a reflection of some sort of belief about how the world should be.
Or the context that it was made in, or so on and so forth.
Exactly. So even something as blandly innocent as fucking Captain Flamingo has political beliefs, even if you don't know what they are.
No, yeah, you're the weird ones for saying that. Like, why are you talking about vigilante justice and the... positives and benefits of self-policing your own community when talking about Captain Flamingo? Because it's relevant, sir.
Because it matters. Like, I think it's funny that you and I have been more insulted when people have called us liberal than the fact that people are annoyed that we have political beliefs on our silly little podcast.
With any hope, after today's episode, they won't be calling us liberal anymore.
And yet, they still will.
I know, it's bizarre. It's bizarre. They can't see anything past that on the political spectrum to the left. It is as far left as they want to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a blanket term that I've never very much enjoyed. Anyway, so for today's episode, we are dealing with a serious subject matter that is attached to the film that we'll be talking about. On the record, in case there was any ambiguity about how we feel about this ongoing issue, there is presently a genocide happening in Gaza as perpetrated by the Israeli government, and both myself and Sylvie would very, very much like to see a ceasefire and land back initiative be implemented in our lifetimes.
From the river to the sea and all of that.
Exactly. We have brought it up on previous podcasts, and we are not shy about it.
And special shout out to all of the university students in their ongoing campus encampments. The kids are doing all right.
University of Toronto is currently having an encampment so they can make the administration divest and divulge their support of the Israeli government to its students. So,
fuck yeah.
It's everywhere, and as it should be. The tide is turning. The political opinion tide is turning on this ongoing quote-unquote conflict in Israel and Palestine.
Yeah.
And, well, with our usual purview of animated television series aimed at children, we wouldn't really get a chance to voice our opinions on this ongoing genocide, but... through some digging and some surveillance of the field of animation here in Canada, we did come across something that was hopefully going to give us a jumping off point to really voice our opinions. Unfortunately, this film is so...
cowardly?
That. There's this necessary need to break down and refute this film that it's pretty much all we're going to be talking about this podcast is how much, how little fun we had with today's subject.
I had a very bad time.
Yeah. So with that being said, you know where we stand politically, and now you will see that in action as we break down a film that I apologized to Sylvie for subjecting her to.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for your apology.
I'll say it on mic too. I am sorry.
People always ask, how do you choose the subjects you write about? It doesn't work like that. I've been coming regularly to the Middle East. I recognize it. It answers to something in me. Over 4/5 of the Israeli state are in favor of building a wall along its borders. This $4 billion wall will be over 4 times as long as the Berlin Wall and twice as high.
They do it because they can. We have the right to render your life meaningless.
It works. 80% of terrorist attacks against Israel have stopped.
We are trapped in this paradox.
The wall is not around us. It's around them.
History has not followed the course we might have wished.
There are people here who have not seen a body of water for 15 years.
This wall is being built to keep people out.
We found a way in.
I know as soon as I look, I'm never going to forget. How do you react to that?
So, for today's podcast, we are tackling a quote-unquote important film, hoping to in part explain the construction and effect on the region and people of Israel and Palestine of the Israel West Bank barrier / Israel apartheid wall, with the kind of nuance that can only come from an outsider tourist perspective. What you really want when dealing with a controversial border dispute, right?
Really, really, when I think of any problem in the Middle East, my first thought is, what do the English think of this, though?
Oh, we'll get to it, but we see from the one Palestinian person that this film bothers to talk to what they think of the English in the best quote of this entire film. But anyway, this is Wall, a 2017 animated documentary adapted by Alberta-based director Cam Christensen from British playwright, screenwriter, and theater directors David Hare's 2009 monologue of the same name.
Wait. So are we not talking about the 1982 experimental film created by English rock band Pink Floyd?
No, no. That was the one time when the Brits had a good thing to say about a wall. This is a different thing. This is a different thing. And
fuck! I watched the wrong movie.
Well, we will pause this and give you an hour and 20 minutes to catch up. So...
Okay. Yeah. You vamp. I'll watch the movie.
Okay. I'll go a little bit more into this film. If you haven't noticed, and this will be important later, the monologue was written in 2009, and the film came out in 2017. A lot has happened in that little buffer there. And a lot has happened between 2017 and 2024, which may point to this film being a little outdated and rendered completely pointless by hindsight. But anyway, if you have not heard of David Hare, he is an absurdly prolific playwright and screenwriter, best known for his screenplays for The Reader and The Hours, both, I believe, nominated for Best Screenplay at the Oscars, and probably known him for one of his dozens upon dozens of socio-political plays that he has released within his native UK. The monologue was pulled from Hare's lifetime of visits to Israel, watching the region change after the country implemented the multi-billion dollar wall construction project, and settles on a amalgamation of journeys that he's taken since the late 2000s, gallivanting around with a London theater promoter named Stephen Hoffman, who is looking to reach out to prominent Israeli and Palestinian playwrights, and the film kind of divests and explores their journey along the wall and the effect that it's had on the people that they come across, trying to really get a personal opinion piece approach by David Hare, dealing with the perspective on the wall and the location. But anyway, we'll break that all down sufficiently when we get to that. The film, most importantly, was produced by our friends at the National Film Board of Canada, which was in reality, and I did not know this before researching, only the second feature-length animated project they produced.
Really? What was the first?
So there was a film from 2016 called directed by Anne-Marie Fleming called Window Horse, the Poetic Persian Epiphany of Rosie Ming. So sometime in 2016, they decided to take their funding strategies and put it into more feature-length projects rather than their bread and butter of short film projects.
I mean, I guess it makes sense. It's genuinely just a surprise that they haven't done that sooner.
Yeah, I mean, they've obviously they have funded plenty of feature-length documentary projects, but animated feature projects were just not in the cards until the late 2010s, which is interesting to think about. So, the film itself was released after an extensive production period, after it's announced, and it was planned for a release in 2014, but it was delayed constantly, and the protracted production of its animation, as you will see when we break it down, took a lot of time to get it right. So anyway, it was finally released and screened at the 2017 Calgary International Film Festival, and then had a semi-successful run of film festivals throughout 2018, before being released in a modest, small window within Canadian theaters, and is now free to stream on the NFB website.
I'm gonna say in this case, I think free is too expensive.
You think that NFB owes you a little bit of money for taking that 82 minutes away from
yes.
you?
Yes, because again, okay. That's 82 minutes I could have spent watching The Wall.
They are actually similar length, yeah. Now that I think about it.
Yeah.
Oh, and just to be very, very clear and have a little bit of fun with it, the animator, the creative director of The Wall, his name I will pull up in like 5 seconds as soon as I can find it. Oh god, where is it? Hold.
Alan Parker?
No, Gerald Scarfe.
Gerald Scarfe. The animator.
Yes, the animator of The Wall, who is very much pro-Palestine.
Hell yeah.
So that's a fun little note to make while we are going to dissect and destroy Cam Christensen's unfortunate project. Before we really get into what's wrong with this film, can we start with a little bit of positivity?
Yeah, is this about Cam Christensen's history?
Partly. It's partly about Cam Christensen's history, but it's more about the techniques and look and aesthetics of this film.
Oh, okay, we're gonna start with why it looked like that.
I think it's necessary to get that out at the top, because I don't think we're gonna be positive for the rest of this hour.
Well, no, otherwise it would be like we'd have the one positivity sandwiched in between just the relentless exhaustion that this movie makes me feel.
Yeah, so let's just bring it out with why it looked like that. This film uses a multi-technique blending of like 3D motion capture, video mapping, and abstract freeform programming, both from animation toolset and the game design toolset, to make the region that Cam Christensen is trying to represent through a monochromatic and lifeless lens. And I hate to admit it, because I don't like the movie.
It looks.
I love
though.
The way it looks.
Yeah.
I love the way it looks. I love the way it moves. I love its strange artificiality. I love the way that you can see these several techniques blending together to try and represent areas of the Middle East that are inaccessible to the filmmakers and have been over the past decade since 2009 when David Hare wrote this monologue to 2017 when this film was released, how much the region has been devastated.
Yeah, it's, God, the road trip portion of this film where he's going through the West Bank looking for, trying to find their way to Nablus is so devastating right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's all coming from a tireless desire to take David Hare's monologue, like, and all the locations that he name checks in that monologue, and represent them as best they can using this technology. According to the filmmaker, he visited every single location that David specifically talks about and took photographs of everything and used them, like, as the basis for all the computer models for the animation in the film. And it comes across as, like, and this is something I'm going to, like, bring up even when we start really attacking this film, is that I think, at least from the Cam Christensen side, maybe even from the David Hare side, all of this came from good intentions.
I could agree with that. I think this is definitely coming from a place of they think they're being truly fair.
Yes, yes. I think in wanting to represent the film using these very innovative and experimental techniques, I think it is coming from a place that Cam Christensen feels somewhat out of his depth in representing the Israel-Palestine areas from an outsider perspective, and he's using this very unique style that he has, sorry, not very unique, just unique style that he has, to give it a strangeness, to give it a alien look, which you could argue is a little dehumanizing and unfortunate, and it comes up a lot with the specifics of his 3D motion capture making a lot of the area unnecessarily ugly at times.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I think there's only, like, two shots of physical places that I would argue, that's pretty, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Three. There's a really nice shot of their car framed by a couple olive trees on the side of the road.
And it's interesting because with Cam Christensen's style, how it is like trying to represent a snapshot of reality, but because it is using all of this technology, like this both animation and game development technology, it all comes across as very janky and artificial and like it's being rendered in a computer.
Well, yeah, there are definitely scenes that look like they belong in a PS2 game.
Yeah, yeah, it's a strange choice, and I'm going to push back on all the negative reviews on Letterboxd. This is, originally, I wanted to make sure, like, okay, since we're going to be doing this film when in our original, like, production planning stage, I wanted to make sure, it's like, is it just because this film is incredibly wrong-headed, or is it something else? Like, is this film just secretly racist? So I looked at the reviews, and most of them are just saying that the animation is weird.
Yeah, and that's not the problem with this movie.
That is the best aspect of the movie.
Yeah, like, the weird animation is honestly the highlight.
Like, they are comparing it to Xavier Renegade Angel. Like, that's a bad thing. Like, no, you don't get that show, and you clearly don't get the intentions behind this aesthetic. Maybe it's because at the time, the mid-2000s, and animated documentaries were still not accepted. We were in a post-Waltz with Bashir world at the time.
Yes.
Which is still the one example everyone brings up of a did-everything-right kind of animated documentary that is purposely playing with reality and fiction.
There's another one.
Oh, there's several, but, like, I think...
I don't know, I was thinking... oh, God, why can't I remember? What's that one? I can't even think. I know what it looks like the poster. is, like, blue, and it's got that, the lady, and she's got, like, Persepolis.
Persepolis, there you go. Another one that is, like, a docudrama based on a real-life account of things. And
yes.
Even more recently, something more relevant to the conversation today, something like 2021's Flea.
I never saw
it. You should watch it. It's wonderful. Or something like 2016's Tower. Again, you need to watch them. But, like, these are all, like, animated documentaries that are trying to represent, like, a story or a history that is so far removed from what we consider to be everyday reality that using the techniques of animation, it can bring it to life in a way that would be more, that is not necessarily more powerful than if it was filmed live action, but more to the point of bringing out a reality through these techniques that was inaccessible through live action.
Well, yeah, it comes down to, because a lot of animated documentaries tend to be like autobiographies,
mm-hmm.
or personal accounts, and that's, animation is so much stronger at being able to delve into individual perception
and memory
than
and memory.
Live action is, exactly, because you can make things can be hazy, things can be like a little exaggerated,
yes.
In the world of fiction, like The Boy and the Heron with the opening shot is like semi because that film is like semi-autobiographical, like a fantasy version of Miyazaki's own,
yes.
memories. And, like, the opening shot of him running to the fire and seeing everyone around him as just this twisting, melting blur is so much more effective. And the same can be said in, even in this case, where I think the physical expression of the wall in this film is probably the most impactful part, like, where it's literally chunks of concrete dropping out of the sky.
Yes.
Is so much more moving and impactful than, you know, just slowly watching a construction crew build something up, like.
Right.
Because that's not how it feels to have your nation torn in two.
So, and, like, it's making it feel so sudden, too, which it did, because at one point you had free reign of what you consider to be your land, and now you are cut off from your farmland. It obviously did not happen, like, as a concrete slab dropped, but having your entire life change around like that, it can feel that way. And that's why the animation technique used there comes in to, like, articulate that feeling. And
absolutely.
This is why I'm, like, leaning on the side of Cam Christensen, at least. He believed what he was doing was honorable and nuanced, and he was at least being very empathetic to the region at large.
I think this movie is visually a lot more empathetic towards the plight of the Palestinians than the narrative is.
Sometimes it feels like it is fighting with the narrative that David Hare has constructed, because there are several moments in this film where David Hare just shuts up for like 5 solid minutes, and we're just getting these really lovingly rendered, and lovingly as in there's a lot of jankiness in it, but
mm-hmm.
lovingly rendered depictions of them driving across the Palestinian rural side against the shadow of the wall. And I think that's more effective than any nonsense that David Hare is spouting.
Yeah, David Hare is full of shit. Cam Christensen, either intentionally or otherwise, is creating these visually beautiful moments of harrowing reality.
Like, even when he has to, when he has to go along with Hare's pontificating, his big brain pontificating about
galaxy brain takes
about the history of the region and how this wall has gone to affect it. Like, there are moments that even taken out of their context and what they're trying to represent are just so strange and unreal that they become so affecting. I'm thinking of the depiction of that discotheque suicide bombing.
Yeah.
Like, the immediate aftermath that it's showing of this smudged, shadowy nightclub space being just with these writhing digital bodies and this constant smoke effect which you can just tell is just layered over everything. And all of the, like, jankiness of the motion now comes to represent, like, bodies in pain and the way it's all constructed. It's really effective.
Mm-hmm. Like, this is a visually very powerful film.
Like, we even get some rough watercolor animation just thrown in there because there's so many different techniques that Cam Christensen was just trying.
Yeah, there's like a segment that where he goes into like ink blot animation, basically. Just he's throwing a lot of stuff at the wall.
Yeah, like it's probably by intention. That's how he's thinking about it. And you get that centerpiece at the end of all of the infamous, just famous graffiti that has lined the West Bank barrier coming to life and moving around and showing that despite being in the shadow of this wall and having their lives torn apart, life is still springing forth through art.
Yeah. And
like, you cannot break their spirits.
Yeah, and I think that element of visual art is, again, so much more potent than anything David Hare could say.
Yeah, because we're an animation podcast, I want to get this out right away. The visuals are stunning. They're very innovative. Like, so much time was spent on crafting this film to look the way it is. And I want to applaud that.
Yeah, I think that is absolutely worth applauding. That there's so much visual care put into the service of something shitty.
What it's all in service of, what it is all representing, is this wrong-headed, self-serving, long-winded monologue by David Hare, which comes across by the end as insufferable both-sides-ism that is not even fair or nuanced.
No, like, it's even in terms of just amount of time spent on either side, like, even when he is physically on his road trip in the West Bank, he's still thinking about his time in Tel Aviv.
Yeah, that's how it comes across. Like, he is I don't want to call him closed-minded, but he's very much set in his ways and his opinions on this this wall being constructed. And it just doesn't seem like anything in the past, like, close to 10 years since writing that monologue and this film coming out, nothing has really changed in his opinions.
Yeah, and that's, God, that speaks to me as just such an arrogant individual. Like, for 10 years... Yeah, exactly. For 10 years to have passed, and you haven't reconsidered anything you wrote 10 years ago.
And it does not help that we are taking a look at this film in 2024, when a lot has happened since 2017 regarding this relationship between these two state bodies. And Jesus Christ, man, like, looking at this film in the cold eyes of 2024, when just this morning Rafah was getting bombed by Israel, to date this recording, but not really, because, God, what day am I talking about?
God, that's happened, what, 7 times already?
So, yeah, thinking about this in 2024, when you have this British intellectual driving along the West Bank and really trying to pontificate, it's like, but what does it really mean for both sides? When you put up a wall, does it not create a barrier and creates two sides to a conflict? But is one right and one wrong? Or is there more nuance here?
Yeah, it's trying to live in the gray area where, like, living in the gray area is such a fucking privilege that the British love to exist in. Like, that's their whole fucking deal when they look at their own history. It's been like, oh, well, there's a gray area here.
Which is so perplexing, because this is admittedly one man's look at the conflict so far removed from any actual, like, quote-unquote skin in the game, because he is an admitted tourist in the region.
Yeah. He just keeps coming back because he wants to visit everywhere. He's perspective, like, he absolutely strikes me as like a medieval studies student.
Ooh,
who
yeah.
is like really salty that people live and develop in these areas
Yeah, just trying to treat like this wall, this conflict, these people casting the shadow of it on both sides as his subject.
He is absolutely the kind of person who would still call Istanbul Constantinople.
And not even quoting that song. Just that.
Yeah,
that.
No.
So I'm just going to read a little line from the New York Times review of this film, written by Ben Kenigsberg. quote, imperiously wringing his hands at both sides of the conflict, Hare never brings his observations together in a satisfying conclusion, not that any was likely in just 80 minutes. He does sound pleased at having appointed himself ambassador. Quote, the artist doesn't choose the subject, he says. The subject chooses the artist, adding that the Middle East, quote, answers to something in me. Does it, though? That's how the review ends.
Oh, that's so good!
I had to bring that out.
That is vicious.
I had to bring that out because that's meaner than anything we can say. Although we're going to, like, circle around the same idea for the next 40 or so minutes. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very kind way of calling David Hare a smug imperialist bastard.
I mean, without saying the C word colonizer, it sounds like that's what Ben wanted to say.
Colonizer recognized colonizer, and I'm 90% sure that that's why he falls mostly on the side of Israel in this case. He pretends he doesn't, but he absolutely does.
But let's get to that, because throughout this entire film, he's trying to present himself as, like, quite literally on the fence about this conflict, and trying to...
On the wall, one might
yes,
say.
Yes, and trying to be a... Damn it. Okay, that just got me. and trying to be as impartial as possible. However, and I clocked this, the only time that he offers an extensive interview with a Palestinian person, like, and even bothers to portray them as, like, empathetic or as somebody with their own mind and opinions on the thing, happens an hour and 5 minutes into an hour and 17-minute movie.
Yeah, and it's not even a real person.
No, I'm speaking on George Ibrahim, the actor that he speaks to.
Oh, that okay. Who, yeah, no, I thought we were on the drive.
No, that's another thing to bring up, is that throughout the entirety of this film, he is spending time with a Palestinian driver, that I'm currently unsure is a real person. Because when this monologue premiered in 2009, that section was not a part of the monologue, and through admission of him and Cam Christensen, was invented for the film. Yeah. So he's clearly... I said before that he's drawing on personal experiences and probably plenty of stories of having road trips along the West Bank barrier. And
yes, this driver is probably like an amalgamation of all of these Palestinian men that he hired to drive him around.
Yes, however, when you have several people from Israel, several intellectuals, several authors who are played by other people, but nevertheless, who are there and speaking their thoughts and having so much time, taking up so much space in your film, and you can't even bring yourself to talk to one Palestinian for longer than 5 minutes.
Yeah, God, that scene is so short too.
It has the best quote in the film of, like, I believe it's George Ibrahim saying, like, we blame everything that happened on the Brits.
Yeah, it's almost like it's their fault.
it's one of the better interviews in the film, because otherwise we have to spend a lot of time with some self-serving, up-their-own-ass theater types that David Hare is really interested in their opinions on.
Oh, God, yeah. The fucking theater critics, I don't know who these people are that he has, like...
They're not named, understandably.
Yeah, well, good, because they would... If I were one of these people and I saw this movie, I would sue, because that's just the most unflattering depiction. But I'm pretty sure it's accurate, because these people are insufferable.
Like, in any more nuanced portrayal of, like, this, like, circle of intellectuals who are, again, just pontificating on the effects of the wall in their region, I feel like anybody sensible, like, shepherding this film, would call them out for their horribly ignorant views.
Yeah. I mean, same with we'll get into David Grossman, but same with him, where it's like, the film just kind of sits with their ideas and leaves them completely unchallenged.
Fully gives them a pulpit, yeah.
Yeah, and they, and so it's leaving people with the ability to say the most unhinged shit you've ever heard. Like, one of these unnamed snobs goes off on, like, how, like, oh, well, I was against the wall, but, like, it's effective. Do you expect me to be angry that it works?
Or from that same friend group trying to push the narrative that, like, hey, listen, this wall degrades us both, not just the Palestinians who, you know, have lost a lot of the acreage of their land and has displaced around, what was the number, like 189,000 citizens of Palestine into the area that they don't claim, or they do claim but like don't have access to. It degrades us both, you see, because we have to live with the fact that we had to erect this wall, and that just makes us look like monsters.
Right? Like, they're so... It's one of those, like, oh, you're so close. You're so fucking close to having an Are We the Baddies moment.
It's insane, because they are looking at this, like, the philosophical and psychological damage that it's done to the Israeli people. Meanwhile, completely just... over, like, looking the material and physical damage it's done to the Palestinian people.
Yeah, and both these snobs and David Grossman are under the impression that their spiritual, like, having to contend with how this was an emotional failure for Israel is actually just as bad as the brutal oppression and massacre of Palestinian people. These things are equally as bad.
That one woman speaking on, like, I try and avoid the wall. I take a longer route to drive because I just can't stand looking at it.
You're allowed to do that, is the thing.
Yeah, that's so nice for you that you can just ignore it.
Yeah, that you have the opportunity to just go to the fucking beach and look at the sea so that you don't have to look at the wall.
And that's, again, that's the crazy thing about this film, is that it's not, like, presenting these ideas as... negative. It's not shading them in a bad light. It's more saying, like, it's taking this nuanced both sides approach, like, well, no opinions on the wall are a monolith, right?
Yeah, it's like I think this is the problem with David Hare writing as a playwright, because he's not a journalist, and any journalist worth their salt would have sat with these statements and then asked follow-up questions. But because he's a playwright talking to his theater friends, he does not want to criticize any of their opinions.
It's an insulated echo chamber where, in all likelihood, David Hare has, like, heard these arguments for as many times as he has gone to the Middle East for one of his vacations.
Yeah, they've definitely had the same conversation over and over and over again.
He's trying to present, like, again, as I've been saying, this nuanced view of the wall from both sides, and trying to really make you believe that there's not one single opinion on either side of the wall about what it means. Meanwhile, if you do any kind of Googling or research about it, the Palestinian population and, like, anybody in a leadership position has been unanimously against it.
Yeah, like, he gives this whole monologue early on about, like, how, wow, 84% of Israeli citizens were for the wall. And, like, when have you ever heard of 84% of people agreeing on anything? Meanwhile, on the other side, Palestinians are, like, 100% against it.
And again, maybe at the time, 2009, he didn't have that data. Sure.
Sure.
But we have enough, since its construction, we've had a lot of time to really gauge the effect it's had on the area and the people. And it's been a net negative, even when the film goes out of its way to show the Hague trial over it, and the United Nations saying, this is not okay.
Yeah, you're not allowed to fucking build cages around people. Like, you can't do that. You have a responsibility as an occupying force. You have a responsibility to not be cruel.
As stated by the Hague in this film, which kudos to both Hare and Christensen, I guess, for including this. The construction of the wall is contrary to international law.
Yep.
But again, they say that, and now we're just kind of like moving forward that, well, it's here now, so let's just deal with it.
Now we just have to figure it out. Huh, there's a wall there now, and I guess we just have to live with that.
Wow, it really, the real crime here, as purported by David Hare and Grossman, doesn't it just really make the Israeli people so insecure about their own status and their homeland?
God, that is, every one of David Grossman's scenes infuriated me, because he would do the thing where he would approach a good point and then double back to, and that's why Israel is the real victim here.
Yeah, it's that, and as well as that mini interview they do with the author of Why Blame Israel.
Mm-hmm.
The same effect, where it's like, we are trying to focus on the wall being a bad initiative for this region. Like, that is their position that they are taking. But you hear them out, and they're just so lacking in any empathy towards the people on the other side of the wall.
Yeah, it's like, it's such peak bully behavior to be like, oh, well, we're insecure, and so we need to feel strong because we're actually really sad and broken. And then David Hare has the audacity to be on the other side of that, seeing Palestinians being treated poorly by the Israeli army, like, and then goes, well, maybe they'd feel differently if they knew that the people on the other side of that wall felt really insecure and sad. And it's like, hey, David, I don't think they care.
Man, it's, I can't believe, like, we erected this wall, and it's made us all feel sad. God damn it, Palestine, why'd you make us do this? That's how it comes across.
Exactly. That is exactly how it comes across, is like, the fucking, it's one big, why are you hitting yourself?
Yeah, it's, what is it? It's, Scottish comedian Frankie Boyle. He's got that one fantastic joke. It's like, America will come to the Middle East, kill all your people and bomb it, and then come back 10 years later with a film crew and make a film about how doing all that killing and bombing made our soldiers sad.
Exactly! It is exactly that!
And, like, the one times, like, David Hare can even be, like, a little bit empathetic towards the Palestinian cause is when he notices how, like, this Holy Land being divided up has really damaged it and made it look ugly.
Yeah, that is his biggest criticism of Israel, is saying that, oh, all of their obsessive settling is ugly. It's not aesthetically pleasing. I want my pretty medieval Middle East.
It's bizarre. And again, he can't even, he's taking this thing. It's like, why are the, if the, he's pointing out a little bit of hypocrisy here. It's like, if Israel is speaking of this land like it's the Holy Land, why are they destroying it? Like, he makes...
Which, and that...
Yeah.
And that comes back to a very prominent idea of settler colonialism,
mm-hmm.
where a lot of the colonized peoples tend to be of the belief that people belong to the land.
Yes.
And the colonizer belief is that land belongs to people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, that is something that David Hare is approaching, but never actually, he can't commit to it.
It's like when he's speaking about the quote-unquote settlements on top of all the hills that the wall is protecting. It's like, well, these are like a deceptive trick of the eye that along the confines of the wall, because they are just ramshackle, empty little housing settlements that have like nothing to do and are just like ugly to the eye. And he said, like, this is the difference between like a settlement and a plantation we're talking about here. And it's like, yeah, that's a good point. Can you now point the finger towards who?
Nope.
Okay. Who spent the $4 billion to make it so?
It's really a gray area.
God damn it. Ah, man, this is... It's really infuriating just how, as you said, he gets very, very close to seeing the forest through the trees and having this epiphany about, like, wait a minute. But he just so...
Is this wrong.
But he's just so stuck in his ways. And he's probably hearing the words of his, like, theater friends about the hard-headed practicality of this wall and why we need it or why it's necessary or why it's a failure that stains us all, but we can't understand a life without it.
Yeah, and it's just like, it doesn't have to be! Like, it's kind of like when as a child, like, you point out something is obviously unfair and cruel in the world, and your parents go, well, that's just the way it is. And it's like, but it literally doesn't have to be. We could just make the world a better place.
Yeah, not even like, oh, that's what God intended, or that's just a natural process. It's like, that's just the way it is.
That's just the way we do it.
Like, a better future is possible, guys. Like, come on.
Yeah, we just have to all team up to want it and decide that it's worth... It's a lot of work.
Is the thing.
To strive for a better future. But they would rather put that work into building a $4 billion wall.
Which, you know, sounds like a lot of work.
Again, yeah, that's a shit ton of work. But it's not emotional work. If I spend $4 billion to build a wall around myself so I don't have to look at the problems that I've caused, then I never need to contend with the problems that I've caused.
Yeah, and David Hare, for as much as his original monologue was written with good intention, at least to him, the way that this narrative is very selective in its presentation, specifically of the people on the Palestine side of the wall, it really is suspect in terms of where his empathies lie.
Yeah, I do also want to call attention to, like, I mean, this is a monologue where, like, much like poetry, the language that you choose to use in a monologue is vitally important.
Yeah, it's the, like, meat of the piece.
It is a style of writing where your word choice has to be so careful. And he even, like, he comments at the very beginning that when you talk about the complications about Israel and Palestine, again, his words, it's the kind of conflict where the words that you use to describe it immediately signal what side of the conflict you're on.
Yes, yes.
Which... So this is a monologue where word choice is so vitally important, and then on top of that, he calls attention to the fact that language is important. And then he proceeds to refer to Palestine, the place, as a savage beauty, refers to Palestinians as idiots, poor bastards, and in one particular case, an Oriental-looking George Orwell type.
This is the character that helps them get to Nablus after their road trip gets sidetracked by being lost.
They just meet this goofy goober of a guy.
Who, again, referring to him as a, quote, Oriental-looking George Orwell. Like, you said it perfectly. Language ascribes intention behind it.
Yeah.
Like, no matter, you are selecting these words specifically to push something. And saying that is highly suspect, sir.
Yeah, so then to turn around and be like, to describe, like, Tel Aviv as beautiful and peaceful, like, his time spent at David Grossman's home, and, like, he's referring to it as a home that is filled with grief because his son died in a war recently, mm-hmm. And it's like, so he's speaking with so much kindness and empathy towards his Israeli friends, and then he speaks so derisively of Palestinian food, even. God, he shits on the dessert that's being prepared in Nablus.
And we'll say right here, this is part of the problem, maybe a little bit, with Cam Christensen's animation technique, because it can't do justice to a wonderful Palestinian treat, and it makes it look like bubbling sewage, which is the greatest, probably the greatest insult of this entire film.
Yeah, is that, God, like, the fact that Hare is like, oh, that's too rich for my taste. And it's like, yeah, I bet it is.
Yeah, for any...
But it's
any...
fucking Brit pepper spicy to you, isn't it?
Oh, man.
God, the fact that this guy is, like, a professional tourist of Israel and Palestine, and yet he can't fucking eat Palestinian food is so just, like, why are you here? Why the fuck are you here, my dude?
Like, honestly, if anybody out there wants to watch this film, again, you can watch it for free on NFB. All you need to give up is your precious time.
Minutes of your life you will never get back.
Look up what they are eating, the kunafa, which is a famous Palestinian dessert, and look what this film does to it. The greatest insult of this entire hour and 17-minute movie is what they do to this lovely-looking dessert.
Criminal. Absolutely criminal.
And again, like, just with this... just the way that he is willing to ascribe so much thought and philosophical attention to the Israeli side of the argument and how they are coming from a place of emotion and how they feel so insecure and how their country feels provisional. Like, they're so fatalist about the quantity of their future. Why aren't you talking to a Palestinian man?
Yeah, like we get so many different opportunities for Israelis to express their own internal conflicts, and he does not offer that same opportunity to different Palestinians. Just the one guy for 5 minutes over three quarters of the way into this movie, and then he has the audacity to be like, oh well, I did my best.
Yeah, like, I think in that same same New York Times interview, review that I read, it begins like, the wall begins with a plane entering into Israel, and it ends with the plane leaving.
Yeah.
Like, kind of sums it all up right there. Like, you don't have a stake in this.
Yeah, you get to leave when all is said and done.
And no attention is paid to that. Like, I don't even think he has the humility or the perspective to really hang a hat on the fact that, like, I am a foreigner and outsider to this land.
Yeah, no, he absolutely feels like he has a right to be here and a right to comment on everything and be taken seriously it's like... You have no skin in the game.
Again, the artist doesn't choose the subject. The subject chooses the artist. He was chosen by the Middle East to comment on it with his self-serving monologue.
Which is a companion piece to another, I assume, self-serving monologue about the Berlin Wall. Because this is his big, like, comparison. Is like, wow, this is just like the Berlin Wall.
Man, again, we're 2017, this film came out.
And I know that, like, the monologue is older, and even, like, this film was in production well before 2016, and gee, I wonder what happened then, but, like, there was a much more, on-the-nose comparison.
Yeah, Wall...
in 2017.
Discourse about walls and their effectiveness got a renewed interest in the political sphere at the time. And someone worth their salt as a political commentator would probably draw that comparison.
Yeah, because I would argue that the Israeli wall and Trump's mystical Mexican border wall serve the same purpose. Like, those are walls that desire to be built out of fear and hatred.
And are, when you really think about it, just a poorly disguised land grab.
Yeah, because same thing. They wanted to build the border wall further south than the American border goes. It's, like, it's so on the nose, and it's so just, like, why did you not halt production on this movie until you could add something? Because that would have been so much better.
I don't want to ascribe any, like, timeline to Cam Christensen's, like, schedule making this film, because it was a protracted production cycle due to, like, the amount of location work both in Alberta and in the Middle East. But when that comparison is just, like, gifted to you, I think the only reason why you don't run with it is because it makes the side that you agree with look bad.
Yeah. That's, again, because David Hare doesn't want to actually have to sit with his thoughts and reconsider something he believed 10 years ago. He doesn't want to have to change his mind.
Yeah. Yeah. This is... This film was, by all accounts of its writing and intention, a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Like, just even thinking about the presentation of ideas masquerading as a nuanced and balanced exploration of this highly controversial subject matter. I wonder then when, like, how poorly he's able to mask that. Because when he's speaking to, actually interviewing the mayor of Nablus, like, he pulls him in for an interview. It's one sentence, and his only sentence is, like, I was held without reason in an Israeli prison for 15 years. Sorry, 15 months, right? Yeah.
Yes. Which is such an insane fact to not examine at all.
But when he says it, like, before, like, he introduces the subject by David Hare making sure that he mentions that, like, he ran on a platform that Hamas would agree with.
Yeah.
Like, that's how he presents this man, is, like, the toady for Hamas.
Yeah, even though he wasn't, like, a member of their party.
Literally, Israel could not find anything legally to charge him with, but they kept him confined in a prison cell. But you make sure to note, it's like, oh, yeah, but, like, you know, like, he's Hamas's boy, right?
This is such a preemptive, like, but do you condemn Hamas?
No, this is the thing. Like, it's putting, like, this film is kind of putting the onus of responsibility, like, on the West Bank people for not speaking out on Hamas hard enough.
Yeah. And, in fact, even he finds, like, one weird cafe owner who's got, like, a poster of Saddam
Hussein.
What
the fuck was that?
And, like, immediately his tone changes. And, like, he goes so hard on, like, well, maybe the wall's a good idea. Like, instantly. He turns on a fucking dime and then seems to, like, cool down and reconsider and go, like, oh, maybe I'm being a little bit mean. But, like, the vitriol with which he was so quickly willing to jump in and be like, oh, well, you know, maybe the wall's a good idea.
To
I guess
completely
I'm right.
Write off the other side because he saw...
You found one weirdo and then a second weirdo who agrees with that him that you just made up.
Like, a dilapidated cafe has a single poster of Saddam Hussein and you said, like, oh my god, these people, what's wrong with them? Have a sense of perspective,
yeah.
Man. What are you talking about?
What the fuck, David?
Ah. Man, and, like, this is not even getting into that one really strange inclusion of, there is a section of this film that details a very bizarre Hamas torture technique.
Yeah.
Just
which is, like,
just felt
why?
The need to throw that in there, maybe because they are, maybe because it involves something being written on a wall. And the impossibility...
Oh, 100%. He heard this story and was like, oh my god, I can use that as an image.
So to detail what he's saying, like, at a party in... I think it's in Ramallah he went to. Hears a story from somebody there about what Hamas does to, like, detractors. The torture technique they do to get them to believe it is they set them in front of a painting of a bicycle and a set of staircases on the wall in front of them, and they say, go get me that bike. And then if they don't get on the bike, they beat them. And that little segment is just thrown into this film, and it makes you wondering, like, so that has, like, nothing to do with the wall?
Yeah, it's literally just, oh, there's a wall in there. That's some, like, high school book report level, like, I'm reaching for
it's,
symbolism.
It's relevant because there's a wall and it involves the moss, and there go, in conclusion, Mrs. Shevesky, I think that the wall is in a state of constant contradictions. Thank you.
It's a paradox.
Oh, man. Okay. We've gone on, I think, long enough.
Oh, we do have to say the best line in the movie. Oh,
please, yes.
Well, it's the conversation with George Ibrahim. I have a different favorite line from that scene. Oh, okay.
Maybe I wrote it down.
My favorite line is, I'm commenting that Israel has no peace movements. A country that has lost its hippies is in trouble.
That is a good line.
Like, it's such a good, and it's also, like, a solid commentary on, like, if you live in a country that does not have a group of, like, young 20-somethings smoking pot and going, oh my god, you guys just don't get it, man, then you are lost.
You can only exhibit so much control over your population to see the way that you want. I mean, and we see it today, even with the several, like, Jewish and Israeli people who have come out against the present policies of Netanyahu. The way that they are ostracized and criminalized within their own community, for speaking out for the other side.
God, like, a Jewish person who's like, hey, maybe don't use the slaughter of my grandparents as an excuse to slaughter more people, immediately you get ostracized. Either, like, even in America, they are quickly ostracized and treated as, like, traitors to Judaism.
Yeah, like self-hating, the stereotypical self-hating Jewish person, or secretly anti-Semitic. It's predictable, but very, very depressing to see how prevalent that is. And in part, it's fueled by, like, close-minded, self-serving monologues like David Hare's.
Yeah. What was your favorite line from that scene?
Oh, it's just the one line of, like, George Ibrahim saying, like, oh, well, you know what the real problem is? Like, we blame you for this. Pointing at David Hare, like, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The British colonizer mindset, like, this is all your fault.
Yeah.
And in a very cheery, fun way, because, hey, like, David Hare can make friends with a Palestinian person.
Yeah, just one, though. Oh, and he likes their baths.
He does. He loves it.
God, that's such a self-serving moment.
No, see, there's good things on both sides. In Israel, you've got the history, the religious beauty, the Tel Aviv, and all the intellectualism. And over here, you got a nice bath. See, I'm being fair and balanced.
This is what I like.
I'm glad that we needed to include that, David, when, again, we are dealing with an ongoing conflict of genocide that you can just get into your plane, not your plane, but a plane, and leave. And then go back to your London apartment and write this monologue.
And then have all of your buddies in Tel Aviv, like, call you up to be like, oh yes, loved it, David.
Finally, somebody's saying it.
Yeah.
Oh, any parting shots at Wall, other than what we brought up at the beginning is that it's a really nice looking film, and Cam Christensen, stick to hockey erotica or something. I don't know, man.
It is a beautiful act of cowardice.
That's a good one. That's a good way to sum it up.
Put that on the box.
That you'd have to special order from the NFB, because I don't think this was released.
And I'm not going to do that.
No. Weirdly, even beyond the Letterboxd reviews that I perused, this was not well received at the time.
I can't imagine why.
Got very middling reviews, which is, you know, perfect for a film that is on the fence. Got him. Okay,
it's on the wall.
So that is going to do it for this episode of Cartoon Night in Canada, Free Palestine. if you like what you heard, and how could you not, we just went on an hour and several minute rant, please consider giving us a like, share, review, and subscribe on your podcatcher of choice, preferably Apple Podcasts, because it helps us reach the widest possible audience. You can find the show on Twitter at Cartoon Night Pod, where we post new episodes every Saturday.
Except when we don't.
You can find myself on Twitter at Cinema Creep, where I don't know, like, I'll compile a couple of donation links for everybody when this episode comes out. We'll also do that on the post itself on the Cartoon Night in Canada Twitter account, just to use this talking point and this episode as a way to do more good in the world than this film ever could.
Let's try to leave the world a better place than how we found it. And that starts with a free Palestine.
There you go. Your plug.
Oh, yeah, you can find me at Sylvie Skeletons, where I will not be posting. I need to fucking sleep after this.
It does take a lot out of you, doesn't it?
This is just
sustained rage. It's tiring. I don't know how people do it. I don't know how the conservative people do it.
I have no idea. Like, how are they not so tired all the time?
Amphetamines?